I'll move to the fourth case this morning, U.S. v. Adams.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Adam Fine, and I represent the defendant appellant, Quante Adams. I'd like to address first the third issue in this case, which is whether or not the conviction for Mr. Adams' alleged possession of marijuana with the intent to distribute.
Can you keep your voice up, counsel?
Yes. I'd like to address the third issue, which is defendant appellant Adams' alleged possession with the intent to distribute marijuana. For a defendant to possess a controlled substance, he or she must have both the power and intention to exercise control over the substance. In this particular case, it's the power that's at issue. The jury instruction that was offered to the jurors in this case did not define the term power. Ordinary dictionary definitions to date would suggest that power is defined as the ability to act or produce an effect on a given item, in this case, the marijuana. And it was precisely that power or ability to act or produce an effect on the marijuana that Mr. Adams did not have and which distinguishes his case from all others. I think particularly instructive are two cases that the government cites in its brief. One is Martorano, and the other is Zavala Maldonado. If I could speak to the first, Martorano. Martorano involved some similar facts, but distinguishable. It involved an exchange of narcotics, phenyl-2-propane, 50 gallons of it, for cash. Mr. Martorano met with the seller of these narcotics, exchanged cash for keys to the substance. The substance was locked in the back of a van that was parked on a street in a city here in the United States. Mr. Martorano took the keys and gave them to a underling, a Mr. DeTijo. Mr. DeTijo, I believe, took those keys over to the van. The keys he had were keys to the padlocked back of the van and to the interior of the van and obviously the engine. Mr. DeTijo got into the van, attempted to start it, and as he sat there, he was arrested. Now, in that case, the majority at note 2, at the second footnote in that opinion, notes what the district court talked about and notes what the dissent talked about in bit, which is simply that Mr. DeTijo actually had the ability to move that car, that he could produce the effect by driving that car away. That is precisely what Mr. Adams could not do in this case. And if on page, I believe, 871 of that same opinion, the majority refers to the district court's ruling, and the district court, too, noted that Mr. DeTijo had the ability, the present ability, to drive the automobile away. That's precisely what Mr. Adams did not have. And in fact, Mr. Adams could not start the car radio, could not turn the windshield wipers on. He could not even start the lighter because the agents had disconnected the battery to the car.
But he intended to drive away with the marijuana inside.
I think that there is no, let me phrase it this way. I think it is fair to presume, based on the evidence, that he had the intention to exercise control over the marijuana in the van. The question is, did he have the power? And this is why I think Martorano and Zavala Maldonado are so important, because they talk about the power to exercise control over the marijuana, not simply the intention. And both must be shown.
So if the engine had started and he had driven a few feet, then that would, in your opinion, be enough to show he
absolutely. I think that's true. As marginal as that is, I think that's true for this reason, Your Honor, because then, under the standard meaning of the term, he would have been able to exercise some ability or effect, produce some effect on the marijuana, that is, to move it from point A to point B. He did not have that. He had no power over it. In fact, as he sat in the cabin of the semi-trailer, next to him was a federal agent. So not only did he have keys that were useless and ineffective with respect to moving the marijuana in to any other location, but he was seated right next to an agent who ultimately arrested him. But in Zavala Maldonado, Had the facts been different, had that car not been started, if you look at page 871 at what the district court was saying and at note 2 at what the majority is saying in that case, it appears to me that they would have come to the conclusion they did not have the power. That is, Mr. Monterano would not have had the power to move the car. With respect to Zavala-Maldonado, excuse me, I mixed those two cases, Zavala-Maldonado is equally important. In that case, Mr. Santos was hired to transport 8 kilograms of cocaine from Colombia to Puerto Rico. When he arrives in Puerto Rico, he meets with a gentleman whose name is Zavala-Maldonado. Zavala-Maldonado is an agent for a principal whose name is Palestino. Mr. Palestino rents a room in a hotel. Mr. Palestino is not there, but Zavala-Maldonado is. Santos arrives, contacts the front desks, asks them to ring Mr. Palestino's room. Mr. Zavala-Maldonado comes down, meets with Santos, brings Santos back up to the room where they sit for a short, brief period. While they're sitting there, they decide to leave the room. When they leave the room, they leave the 8 kilograms of cocaine in a closet in Zavala-Maldonado's room. As they leave, very shortly thereafter, they're both arrested. In that case, what the court said is this. It was the First Circuit, I believe, in that case. And they said, because the item was left in Mr. Zavala-Maldonado's room, and because he had come down from that room when called, and he summoned Mr. Santos back up to that room, let Mr. Santos into that room, shared that room with him, and he was the only other occupant, Mr. Zavala-Maldonado, that he had power over that room. When they left that room, they left the cocaine in there, that altered the balance, and that gave him some degree of constructive possession over the item in that room. Now, in that case, too, had the facts been changed and the government completely controlled that room, Zavala-Maldonado would not have had constructive possession of the item in there. He only had that constructive possession because he had constructive possession over the room. In this case, if you go back to the item in the van, there was no constructive or actual possession over the items in the back of the van because Mr. Adams had absolutely no power, no ability, no present ability to produce an effect or to act on the marijuana, very much different from Zavala-Maldonado, very much different from Mr. Maturano as well. I think all the other cases the government cites are distinguishable. Quickly and fairly easily. They'd cite the Toro case, which took place in a Houston parking lot, and in that case, a defendant took 1 kilogram of cocaine, placed it into his briefcase, and walked away. As he walked away, he was arrested. He obviously had it in his briefcase. In Jones, another case cited from the Eighth Circuit, the defendant helped move 2 bales of marijuana into his own van, then got into his own van. No doubt that his own van operated well. Also in Posner, in that case, the defendant got into the car. The car was owned by agents, but the car was operating. There's no indication it wasn't, and it was fully loaded with narcotics. So in all of those cases, the defendant at least had the present ability to produce some effect, however nominal, however for however brief a period of time, over the item in question, drugs in whatever case they were. In this case, it's quite different, and Mr. Adams never had that power precisely because the keys he was given were wholly ineffective. They could not move that car an inch. He could not operate even something as marginal as the car lighter in that car. So in terms of possessing the marijuana that was in it, it simply was not possible from him, and the facts in this case are distinguishable and starkly different from the facts listed in the cases cited by the government. And I think again, a careful reading of Zavala-Maldonado and Maturano reveals that, and they precisely reflect on what it means to have that power. With respect to the speedy trial issues, a couple of things about the government's citations in that case. The government cites 3 cases for the proposition that the Speedy Trial Act starts anew when the last defendant is arraigned. Now, that is generally true, and the U.S. Supreme Court said it is generally true in Henderson versus United States, which the government cites. However, in Henderson and in all the other cases cited by the government, all defendants were joined in the original indictment. Defendants were not subsequently added through superseding indictments. In this case, Johnny Johnson, the last defendant who was arraigned, was added through a superseding indictment more than a year after Mr. Quante Adams had already been taken into custody, held, and arraigned himself. I would suggest that that's a distinction that does make a difference. If the government is allowed to add on defendants over time through superseding indictments, it defeats the very purposes of the Speedy Trial Act. There are three in the main. One is to ensure that defendants do not stay confined pretrial for an extensive duration, particularly if they are found not guilty. They ought not languish in local jails or in federal detention centers. Two, those who are on bond, the public should not be subjected to the potential danger that they may hold for the public for an extended period of time. But in addition, the public has an interest in general deterrent value of swift and certain punishment. And the longer defendants are detained in jails and in federal detention centers, the more time that passes, the less certain, the less swift.
Of course, there were a number of continuances requested by defense counsel in May of 2004, which was just 5 months after the initial appearance, and then June of 2004, and all that time was excluded. February 18th.
There are a number of continuances requested by the attorneys for Mr. Adams. Some of those, all of them, I think if you look at them, particularly the initial ones, are fairly bare bones. One is for plea negotiations. That's all it says. And Mr. Adams, in a letter to the court, indicated that he never authorized his attorney to enter plea negotiations. Another one is to determine if the defendant was a career offender because they learned that there was a prior, the attorney learned that there was a prior conviction out there that the government alleged would qualify Mr. Adams as a career offender. That matter could have been resolved by picking up the phone and calling pretrial services within about 18 seconds or visiting their office to make that same determination. I wouldn't think a continuation of the trial date for months would be required for that purpose. In addition, I think the very number of continuances offered under Section H8 of the Speedy Trial Act in this case suggests there's a problem. Ends of justice continuances are not to be routinely and easily or liberally granted, but are to be granted sparingly. There were countless number of continuances granted in this case. And in no case, when they were granted, did the judge go through the weighing of the factors at H8B, Romanets 1 through 4. And those factors are mandated under the Act. I think a case that's interesting on that point is this, Taylor versus United States, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case that dealt with Section 3162 of the Speedy Trial Act. That deals with whether or not the case ought to be dismissed with or without prejudice. What's interesting
now,
there...
Let me just ask you this. You know the Supreme Court took cert on an Eighth Circuit case, Bloat versus U.S., to determine whether the pretrial pretrial motion time is excludable under the Speedy Trial Act, that is, setting the time for filing of pretrial motions. Do you
Correct.
Think we should wait for the court's decision before we
Well,
move?
I think the court's decision will be illuminating.
In this case.
I think it will be illuminating, and I would say this about that. Bloat is also distinguishable here because in this case, the court simply sua sponte set a date for filing of motions. In Bloat, the defendant requested some additional time. But I do think Bloat was a meaningful case, and I do think it would be worth waiting to see what happens. Also, with respect to the pretrial motions issue, the court, the government cites Montoya. Montoya is a Seventh Circuit case that goes back to a First Circuit case called Jodan. If Jodan is read carefully, what happened in that case is this. The defendant requested time for pretrial motions. It was granted by the court. Then the court determined ultimately that it was properly excluded from the Speedy Trial Act. Montoya did not deal with the same set of facts. In Montoya, there was no request for that time, so I think Montoya's cite to Jodan is somewhat misplaced. And, in fact, most of the cases cited by the government, including the recent First Circuit case that it cites, the First Circuit says pretrial motion time should be excluded if the trial judge at the time in the record, either orally or written, indicates that that time is to be excluded from the speedy trial clock. That did not happen in this case, and that case cited by the government is not a posit for that reason. And in fact, the other cases it cites suffer from the same defect. That is, in those cases, there was a request generally made by the defendant for that additional time. In this case, there was not. It was simply granted. With respect to the continuances that were granted by Judge Herndon in this case, I would ask the court to look at whether or not the factors were weighed. That is, the factors that are listed at Romanets 1 through 4 and 8b. And the reason, again, that's important is in Taylor, the Supreme Court said it shall weigh these factors. The court must weigh these factors. That court did not weigh the factors in this case, and that renders those continuances in part one of the reasons why they are ineffective and fail under the Act. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel has indicated that the issue on possession should hinge on whether or not the defendant was able to drive the vehicle away, but I don't believe that that is the case. There's absolutely no reason why he needs to drive the vehicle away to possess it. He could have, for instance, simply gone to the back of the van, picked up the marijuana, and he would have possessed it. And possessed it with the intention to maintain control over it. The cases that the government has cited in its brief, I believe, are relevant to this case and do suggest that the defendant in this case had at least constructive possession, if not actual possession. Several of them, or at least two of them, I believe, indicate that upon taking the keys into his possession, the defendant possessed the controlled substance. And also, commenting on my opponent's argument here, he seems to suggest that the defendants in these other cases could have apparently driven a short distance, but the reality was that the agents were there on the scene to arrest and did arrest those defendants. So I don't see that the driving away really is relevant to the issue here, particularly in this case where he had access to the interior of the van.
Okay, you're aware of the Eighth Circuit and the cert being granted in that Bloke case. Do you think we need to wait before we rule to hear what the Supreme Court says about that excludable time for filing pretrial motions?
Your Honor, I don't think that it's necessary to wait, but on the other hand, I suppose it would be prudent to wait.
And why do you think it's not necessary? I understand you're saying it would be prudent, but is there any argument for us moving ahead?
No, Your Honor. I would suggest that the court go ahead and wait. And, Your Honors, I believe that with respect to the Speedy Trial Act, the judge in this case did provide adequate explanations for why he was continuing the case in each instance. And I would note that many of these continuances were granted at the defendant's request, and therefore the government doesn't believe that that it should be prejudiced by the defendant's own requests for continuances.
I guess I was asking that question because maybe I have this wrong, but was it from March 2nd to March 12th that the time was allowed to file pretrial motions and those 10 days were excluded?
Your Honor, there is that period that was excluded for you're talking about the discovery order
yes.
back in 2004. Yes, ma'am.
Was there any other time? I just want to make sure I have the record correct. Was there any other time excluded with respect to pretrial motions?
There was, I believe, yes, there was time excluded because of pretrial motions, but not that have been addressed by the defendant in the appeal.
Okay, because I guess my question was whether so 10 days would make or break it in terms of the clock.
Oh, starting. I see what you're saying. Well, the judge actually found with respect to the number of excludable days that only 21 non-excludable days had elapsed and this is in his December 22nd, 2006 order, only 21 non-excludable days had elapsed if you measure that date from the date that the last defendant was arraigned.
Okay.
So it really wouldn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm. So that would make it 31 days if that was, I mean.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So just in brief summary, the judge did express on the record, if not contemporaneously in deciding the motion, then certainly in the transcript of the hearing that has been appended to the briefs, as well as his December 22, 2006 order. Consequently, I believe there was no violation of the Speedy Trial Act, and we'd ask for the court to affirm the decision of the district court with respect to the with respect to all counts except for the money laundering count.
And you're conceding there was insufficient evidence in that count?
I'm sorry?
And you're conceding there's insufficient evidence in that count?
Yes, sir, for the reasons stated in the brief. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Time. You have 1 minute, Mr. Fine.
Your Honor, the government suggests that whether or not Mr. Adams could move that car is not important, but whether or not he could move that car precisely goes to whether or not he had any power over this item. And I would suggest it's that fact that indicates he did not and that distinguishes him from all the other cases cited in the government's brief. In addition, the government adds today that Mr. Adams could have gone to the back of the van and removed items from there. There is no evidence in the record that he could have done so. That is a fiction that is raised for your consideration today. The fact of the matter is that power must mean something. The jury instruction says power and intention. The intention may be there, but there must be the power as well. The Marotano case and the Zavala-Maldonado case both discuss that in detail. The reason it exists in Zavala-Maldonado is that that gentleman had possession of that room. If that room had not been his possession, he would not have had a constructive possession over the items in that particular hotel room. In Marotano, the same is true. For those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse that conviction.
Mr. Fine, you as well have taken this case by appointment?
I have, Your Honor.
Have the thanks to the court for your fine job representing your client.
It's my privilege, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement. We move to